Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is February 13th, 2013, but this podcast will be posted later. The title of today's podcast is My Generation. Yes, we're going to be talking about generational issues and the disruptive nature of social media. The reason this case has come up, because we always like to start the SGEM with a case, is that there's been some tension created with this disruptive technology. The SGEM is having an impact, and I can't tell you how pleased I am that the SGEM is reaching people and having an impact. One definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. And if we expect to shorten knowledge translation from the average of about 10 years to less than 1 year, we can't keep doing the same thing over and over again. And that's where this social media comes in. So let's see if we can cut that KT window down to less than 1 year. But I recognize that doing that may create some tension. And that's some feedback I've had recently. Tension has been created by the SGEM. And it's a generational tension between the learner and the master. And so I've assembled a team of experts to help me address this question and give the SGEM listeners some insight and some advice on how to use this social media in their day-to-day learning and practice of emergency medicine. So we're going to start with a case, and the case is a bright young woman who's in her emergency medicine training, and she approaches her consultant after listening to an episode of the SGEM. And the case is she addresses with her consultant, and maybe not in the best way, that she had heard something on the podcast that conflicts with the evidence she's hearing. How does she go about reaching her consultant with this information? How does she broach the subject? How does she say, really? I don't think that's the latest, greatest information, and I don't think that's the best for the patient. So I've got a bit of a round table here. I've got three people. I've got Chris, Peter, and Greg. And Chris, Peter, and Greg are going to introduce themselves. So Chris, could you go ahead first as one of our experts?
I'm Chris Carpenter at Washington University in St. Louis. I serve as Director of Evidence-Based Medicine here.
Thank you, Chris. And Peter?
Yes, my name is Peter Benegas, and I'm an associate professor of emergency medicine also at Washington University, and I'm the co-director of our stroke network and spend a considerable amount of my time interacting between emergency medicine and the world of neurology, particularly involving stroke.
Ooh, great. Why don't we use you as an expert in neurology, and we'll make the case that the conflict or the dissonance with the student and teacher is about stroke management. That'll be good. And then we have one other individual joining us today. Greg, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Greg Politis. I'm an associate professor also at WashU, and I'm the course master of the practice of medicine for the first and third year medical school classes here. And I also teach a class on the undergraduate campus that reaches out to about 500 pre-med students a year.
Oh, great. So why don't we start with you, Greg, then? Can you tell us what a generational learner is, or can you give us some breakdown of the different types of generational learners in the next couple of minutes?
Sure. So we basically define someone born in Gen Y as anyone roughly between the ages now currently of 11 years old to 36 years old, someone who was born between 1977 and 2002. Others use different dates, but essentially, it's that generation that was basically the offspring of the echo. It's also known as the echo boom from the baby boomer generation. They're about 70 million strong. They're the fastest growing segment of the workforce. All of us that are in medicine and also corporations are now dealing with the large influx of this generation of students. I think the characteristics that really define Gen Y are that they have very high expectations of themselves. They have high expectations of their employers as well. And this leads to some of the things that we're going to talk about today. They definitely enjoy continued learning, and they want immediate responsibility. just like other students who have entered medicine in past generations are very goal-oriented, service-oriented. But with Gen Y, they tend to really be a little bit more impatient. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they grew up in the computer generation. Some would say Generation Y students would rather be unemployed than take a job that is beneath them. They come in with financial smarts. They want a definite balance between work and life. They definitely like change. And many in Gen Y in careers other than medicine will actually have multiple careers throughout their lives. They also enjoy collaboration. They're very good with regard to teamwork. But then there are other characteristics as well. And some of these other characteristics cause kind of this conflict between the current culture of medicine and what they've been exposed to throughout their whole lives. So some of these is that, and this is very general, so I know that this doesn't apply to everyone, but a lot of people would agree that Generation Y students have been somewhat pampered and nurtured throughout their whole life because it's the most child-centered generation ever. They tend to seek a lot of feedback and guidance and also recognition. So even though they grew up in an era where they're accessing information very quickly and they want to start at more kind of mid-level management positions, they also want a lot of guidance and feedback along the way. A lot of this kind of has to do with the fact that they've been programmed with a slew of activities since they were toddlers. Some refer to Gen Y students as trophy kids.
Greg, I like that, the trophy kids. Now,
right.
could you contrast that to their main educators, which would be the baby boom generation? Because I think that's where, sure, you know, most of their educators,
right,
would be baby boomers. Is that correct?
Yes, I agree with that. And the way I think of it is that the baby boomers were actually taught by the generation before us. And that generation viewed the whole work-life balance in medicine very differently than Gen Y people do. And so that's where that conflict comes in.
So what are baby boomers like then? What are the SGEM, you know, if they're a resident med student or early physician, what are their baby boom doctors teaching them like? What are their priorities and styles?
Well, I think that we are trying to adjust. I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say conflict, but there's a lot of adjustment that we have to go through because we kind of have this hybrid. We were taught by those before us that you know, medicine is your life to some degree, that, you know, you don't go home until the work is done, that kind of attitude that you know, many in the generation before us, they live to work, not work to live. Or this generation is the opposite. So here we're trying to adjust to the values that they're bringing into their training early in medical school with what we were taught by those before us. And that's where I think this kind of conflict arises. When you ask a third-year medical student to stay over, they sometimes can look at you, you know, a little strangely, like, well, you know, my time is up, and you know, it's time for me to go. Not all students are like that, but we do notice some definite things. I recall one time several years ago when I had a student, I asked when I was a resident myself. So this would have been young, early in Gen Y, but
don't date yourself too much there, Greg. And you know, and when you say words like "when I was a resident,"
right,
everybody starts
right,
rolling their eyes.
Well, but it seems like every year it's getting further and further away, though. So, but I remember asking a third-year medical student to help me out with looking up some labs on a patient, and I was an intern at the time. And the student looked at me and said, "You know, isn't that the job of the intern? You know, I'm really supposed to be in the OR."
Wow, and that must have gone over, you know, well with you.
Yeah, that was really kind of a shocker. And so the thing too, this independence that students have learned from growing up in this child-centered generation has kind of taught them to question authority so much. You know, authority is not something that's just expected like those in the baby boomer generation, but it's really something that needs to be earned. And I think that's where some of this conflict comes in,
well,
where students feel much more likely to speak up.
Greg, I really appreciate you sort of laying down a good basis of the difference between Gen Y and baby boomers, or millennials and baby boomers. And I'm going to post some extra information on the blog so people can look into that deeper. But I think this brings us now to bring some of the other individuals into this conversation. And that's with the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine and using social media as a disruptive technology. It is causing a bit of disruption, and the Gen Ys are the ones using social media. And just so people are on the same page, one of the definitions of disruptive technology or disruptive innovations is an innovation that helps create a new market or value network that eventually goes on to disrupt an existing market or value network over a few years or decades, displacing an earlier technology. And certainly by, you know, people doing Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and listening to this podcast, these are all examples of that. There was a Canadian named Marshall McLuhan who said, the medium is the message. The medium is the message. And when these young Gen Yers are coming forward with this information, whipping out their smartphone and looking up a PubMed article or using Trip database to find something, they're showing that the medium is the message. And that's a disruptive technology, and it's a little unsettling. What they need is a bit of a filter. And so I want to bring Chris Carpenter into the conversation and ask Chris, you know, when they're using this disruptive technology, what's a healthy skepticism? Because they need to know how to critically appraise the literature. And that's sometimes what these young learners are missing. So can you bring in sort of an idea of what it is to be a critical reviewer of the literature or a skeptical individual, Chris?
It's a great question, Ken, and that pertains directly to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. This is the linchpin of SGEM, right?
Correct.
Healthy skepticism, I wrote an article about, I will give you the hyperlink to it so that you can provide it to your readers on the website, but there's really three key components to that. One is that evidence alone is never enough. I'll repeat that. Evidence alone is never enough. For evidence-based medicine is this Venn diagram, triad of patient preferences, clinical expertise, and the evidence. And sometimes there's not evidence to answer every question. Where there is evidence, we need to recognize that evidence exists and evaluate it within the context of what we already know. Second component is that there is a hierarchy of evidence. Not all evidence is created equal. And so some evidence, like a case report or a case series, is probably more biased, more subject to the interpretation of the author, the researcher, and the journal editors than is a series of well-conducted randomized trials where you try to randomize out the different biases, the different confounders between populations. We need to recognize that not all evidence is created equal. The third component is that there's a tipping point. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a whole book about this topic.
I like that Malcolm Gladwell guy. He writes a lot of provocative books.
Makes you think.
It does.
And that 10,000-hour plateau, whether it's playing a piano or playing football or reading the literature, applies. You need to have repeated exposure, and not just repeated exposure with a knowing mentor who can point out your flaws and what you're doing well so that you can move forward. And that applies to critical appraisal as well. In order to do this well, we have to have practice critically appraising. We need to have somebody looking over our shoulder saying, this is what you understand, this is what you don't understand, this is how you can learn more. So you put those three things together. Evidence alone is not enough. There is a hierarchy of evidence, and there's a tipping point of expertise. And I think that's what constitutes healthy skepticism for your SGEM listeners. This is really important because some of your listeners may be aware of the Flexner Report. And in the 21st century, there's a new Flexner Report that's been put out by the same foundation, the Carnegie Foundation. It's called Educating Physicians, A Call for Reform of Medical School and Residency by Molly Cook, David Irby, and Bridget O'Brien. And let me read you three of their seven recommendations that apply directly to what we're talking about today. Fundamental changes in medical education in the 21st century will require new curricula, new pedagogies, and new forms of assessment, specifically to support learners' responsibility for quality of care, team performance, and their own learning while providing skilled supervision. Two, to cultivate a spirit of inquiry and improvement in learners and in healthcare teams. The spirit supports both innovations in daily practice that translate into better service to patients. We're doing this for the patients, right? System improvement and improved patient outcomes, as well as the development of larger research agendas, new discoveries, and knowledge building. And three, to be more intentional about our selection, development, and support of teachers and medical educators.
That's great, Chris. I appreciate those insights. The students have acquired some great power. This social media is a great power. These smartphones that people carry around offers them great power. And I want to make sure that I'm quoting various generations here. So I'm going to put, with great power comes great responsibility. Any of you guys know where that came from?
Spider-Man?
It was Spider-Man, but it wasn't Peter Parker. It was his dad, or sorry, his uncle, Uncle Ben. And, you know, with this great power, this ability to access information on the fly, you have to exercise it responsibly and recognize that the people that are teaching you have something to bring to the table too. And it's called experience and context. And just because you have a randomized clinical control trial, that's not evidence-based medicine. Evidence-based medicine is that Venn diagram that you described that takes into all these different aspects to provide, and I'm so glad you brought it up, Chris, the best patient care. Because in the end, it's not about the student, it's not about the professor, it's about the patient. And we're all here, we're all working on the same team, and we all want to provide the best patient care. So how about we, after bringing up some healthy skepticism, why don't we move forward there to, Peter, you still there in Hawaii?
I sure am.
Peter, I really appreciate you getting up so early. This is how committed people are to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Peter has gotten up at 4 o'clock in the morning in Hawaii to be able to do this podcast. So, Peter, thank you very much. Let's go to the case that we were talking about this young resident who was involved with, let's say, a thrombolysis case, because you're an expert in this area. Could you give me an example of how maybe not to bring up maybe a controversy with you, something that would get under your skin as the attending physician coming down? Could you give me an example of how you would not appreciate it? Because sometimes we learn more from, hey, you know, that wasn't the best. Can you give me an example like that, Peter?
I sure could. and these examples occur quite frequently. And as, you know, listening to the discussion of generational learners, and personally, you know, I feel like I'm straddling the fence on many issues here. As a baby boomer, Generation X, really at right on the cusp of both generations, and in the world of neurology and stroke, I really kind of wear two hats on a daily fashion. So, in the world of thrombolysis, we certainly know, if we practice in emergency medicine, that there is controversy involving this topic, and the controversy has originated since the original NINS trial published in 1995 in New England Journal of Medicine. And since then, there's been a very healthy skepticism within our specialty, which is acting more like a Generation X or millennial type specialty compared to the traditional baby boomer traditionalist neurology generation, which was very evidence-based, very slow to adapt new technology, but really kind of driven by the best available evidence and very slow to change. So for example, in a setting of thrombolysis, we know in the year 2013, not to date this podcast, that in the setting of stroke, a patient has really one option, and if eligible, who arrives to the emergency department, and that would receive a IV form of a thrombolysis called TPA. We know certain patients will actually be eligible for this therapy, and many or most will not. It is not a therapy that comes without risk, and that's what really a lot of emergency physicians kind of grapple with. So we are faced with compelling data that comes through the literature and through clinical practice that folks feel there's clinical equipoise stating that patients, if qualified or eligible, will receive benefit for receiving this treatment. In our Generation X millennial kind of thought process, there are many thoughtful individuals out there who have actually taken some of this original data and some of these original studies really to task and actually have challenged it. So, and particularly using this media podcast, Facebook, and really a lot of the newer technology that's really outside the traditional medical literature.
Well, so, Peter, I just interrupt you there. I mean, I think you're really framing that issue quite well in such a short time period, because it is a big elephant in the room when it comes to emergency medicine. And, you know, people can tweet in 140 characters or less, no TPA or yes TPA. It doesn't take very many letters, does it? But what I was hoping that you could do is give us an example of, you know, in this case, that a resident comes up to you and says something to you. And so I'll act as the resident here, Peter.
Sure.
I just listened, doctor, to a podcast last night, and it says the IST-3 trial says you're nuts to be using thrombolysis in this case. What's going on?
Exactly.
Would that be a good way to bring it up with you, Peter?
It certainly is in a setting that is not time critical and at the patient's bedside. So I would agree, a healthy discussion concerning the best available literature, and that's where best available really is up for debate. But at the time of service to a patient, where really we have to make the decision based upon best available evidence and best available experience, quoting a podcast at the bedside for a patient who has a really life-threatening condition and then challenging existing prevailing mood and treatment is probably not the best time to actually be bringing up that information. So I agree with the information and the process, but the setting is certainly inappropriate, at least for someone who has come up through the baby boomer generation kind of experience.
Okay, Peter, I'm not afraid to admit I've got a fragile ego. I've got a fragile ego, and there are good ways to bring things up with me and not so good ways to bring things up with me. And certainly the nurses I work with know how to help steer me in the right direction from time to time. And I think when it comes to learners, that we all appreciate if we could have a discussion about it and that we are open to discussing about it, but in the appropriate setting, at the appropriate time, and in the appropriate manner. And sometimes that might not be on the fly, like you said, in front of a patient facing a critical illness with a life or death decision. Thrombolysis for recovery, thrombolysis with risk of intracranial hemorrhage and death. I mean, that's not the time to be having this debate, correct?
Correct. I certainly think it generates a very, where people's opinions are taken seriously, but there's a time and place to have those decisions. So I agree, not the appropriate time and place, but certainly an appropriate question.
So if you could give some advice to a student or a trainee or a resident, what advice would you give them, Peter, on how best to bring up this information in the future?
I would never want the learner, the student, or the residents who feel that their point of view was not welcomed. I would certainly the opposite. I would want them to challenge their teachers, to challenge their professors, to the prevailing data and really kind of how we approach the patients. But I know I would want them to do that really in a setting that it would be more appropriate, away from the bedside, maybe in a team discussion, in a manner that actually could actually generate some discussion and maybe actually kind of stimulate some research kind of offline, but not to interfere with the direct patient care. Though I would never want to really kind of quell a learner from actually interacting or stopping someone from doing something they thought was unsafe, I certainly think questioning at the bedside, in front of family, in front of nursing staff, in front of other physicians, is probably not the most productive way all the time to get your message across.
Great. Well, thanks, Greg. Peter. Greg, I think this is a chance to bring you in because you deal with more lecture settings. How about bringing up these issues in a lecture setting? Because, you know, I was speaking to Chris earlier today, and he said, what's the incentive for a professor to come with a new set of slides? What's the incentive for a professor to teach, I don't know, first-year medical students certain concepts that they may not have stayed up on the literature, and there's not really any incentive, at least from a financial standpoint, I understand it, as a lecturer, to stay up on that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, kind of going back after what Peter had mentioned, you know, this is actually a talk that I do give to the pre-med students who are still trying to figure out if medicine's the right thing for them. The lecture is actually titled The Intersection of Medicine and the Y Generation. I haven't given such a talk for our medical students yet, and I do think that is appropriate. I think the key is, you know, when Chris mentions about what's the incentive for a lecturer, we definitely want students who are engaged, and we want students who are wanting to kind of have that healthy skepticism and question. But I think a lot of it just has to do with, like we mentioned, the way in which it's done. And that's where I think some of the upbringing of students, and this sounds bad because it almost sounds like I'm blaming parents of kids today. It's so commonplace to question authority that it can be done in a way that comes off as having very little tact.
So you want them to have some tact. You want to have them manage our fragile egos, right? And so perhaps coming up to the lecturer after the presentation and saying, hey, you know, I really enjoyed your lecture. You know, so start with something positive. This is all about, you know, adult education. I really enjoyed your lecture. You get a lot more with honey than you do with vinegar. I really enjoyed your lecture, Professor. I was just doing some reading about this, actually, or listened to a podcast recently about this, and they mentioned this other stuff. I'd really like the opportunity to talk to you more about this. Do you think that would go over well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than, excuse me, in the back row, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, it's not even about my fragile ego. I feel like that was broken long ago as when I was a resident, so I don't worry so much about my ego. But I do feel that this is a practical life skill that students need to know. You know, throughout their entire career, there's always going to be ways to interact with patients, with colleagues, with superiors.
We work in a healthcare team, don't we? We work in a healthcare team. And that healthcare team needs to have feedback, but needs to have interaction and communication that's positive and productive. Because as Chris said earlier, we're all there for the patient, right? We're all there for the patient. I want to bring in another quote just to bring some more people into this so we can cover all the generations in this. And that would be maybe a negative way to go about it. And then let's wrap up with a positive way. This is a quote from, and I'll ask you listeners to figure this out, my panel, quote, "When I left you, I was but the learner. Now I am the master," end of quote. You know where that's from?
Was that from Star Wars?
Oh, yeah, baby. That was Darth Vader. That was Darth Vader talking to Obi-Wan Kenobi saying, you know, "When I left you, I was just the learner, but now I am the master." Well, these students may be the master of social media, but they are not the masters of medicine, and we need to work together again for the best interest of the patient. So we're running short on time because it's such a great conversation. I'd like to do the case resolution, and I think the case resolution from a thrombolytic standpoint with the bedside is already been given that it's probably not the best time and place to bring it up right at the bedside in front of the patient, and that there's more appropriate ways to do it. And again, if it's in a lecture setting, to talk to your lecturer after the lecture and give that kind of constructive feedback, such as, hey, that was a great lecture. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for taking your time to come and teach me today. I'm really interested in this topic too, and here's some information I found out about it. Could we talk more about that and maybe bring it up in the next lecture when they give the talk? I think that would be a good case resolution. What do you guys think?
I agree completely. I believe that you can pretty much ask any question of anyone if it's done the right way.
Well, there's a few things to wrap up the whole podcast. I want to go around and ask each of you, so put your thinking caps on, to give me a 30-second clip of what your final thoughts on this issue is about my generation and the generational issues about medical education. I'm going to finish up with one of my heroes, Charles Darwin, Origin of the Species. Could I dig deeper? So the quote I wanted to finish up with was the following. "I think it inevitably follows that as a new species in the course of time are formed through natural selection, others will become rarer and rarer and finally extinct. The forms which stand in closest competition with those undergoing modification and improvement will naturally suffer most." And I certainly don't think that this is a thing about competition. I think this is about collaboration and communication. And yes, as older physicians, we will work through our way, and the younger physicians will bring us new technology, new ideas, and enrich our practice and be able to provide the best care for our patients. And so we should try to embrace that. I hope I spoke long enough to go around the room here in the virtual room and say, Chris, any final thoughts, 30 seconds or less, about my generation?
think we've made a nice case for how the students should present these questions and when they should be presented. I think the challenges to the institution to provide that setting for the students, whether they be medical students or residents or postgraduates, to ask those questions if it's not at the bedside. And I will throw out there the challenge and the opportunity to your listeners that if they want to become these local opinion leaders, there are resources out there. In emergency medicine, there's the BEAM courses. They occur every year. They're all over the world. We'll put a link up to, on your website so that they know how to access the BEAM courses. There is McMaster Evidence-Based Clinical Practice course. There's the New York Academy of Medicine TEACH course. And if you're related to diagnostics, I'm co-director of the UCSF Evidence-Based Diagnostics course. Take advantage of these opportunities to become your local expert.
All right, well, let's move on to Hawaii. Peter, can you give us some final thoughts from Hawaii?
I sure can. You know, as I sit here thinking about what has been said, you know, I think it's first and foremost important to understand where you're coming from and where you fit into your generation, because I think you have to understand how you learn. And then I think more importantly, putting a plug out to our millennials, our Generation Y, how our audience is learning. Because I think if you can give the best PowerPoint presentation known to man, but it does not reach your audience, I think you failed as an educator. So I think it's up to the Generation X and the baby boomers to really embrace the new way of our learner and actually bring the new forms of technology to our audience in order to actually get our message across. So I certainly sit as a baby boomer Generation X, but I certainly recognize that the millennials do learn differently, and it's our responsibility as educators actually to meet their needs.
And Greg, we'll finish up with you, and I'm going to challenge you, Greg, before you give me your final thoughts. I want you to make a YouTube video of whatever lecture you give to these medical students about this issue and agree to post it on the SGEM so we can throw it up there and everybody can benefit from your lecture.
Maybe I'll be like Sly the Rapper. So I think the last words I'd like to say is I think that it really is a responsibility of medical educators to think thoughtfully about this issue, because part of teaching the complete physician is partly how to interact with your colleagues and kind of those interpersonal ways to go about doing things in the proper way. I think on our end, it's our responsibility to also be informed and up to date and stay on top of what we need to know, and also be open-minded to the fact that we can also learn from those that are younger than us. Because working with our medical students, honestly, you know, next to the clinical practice of medicine, to me is probably the thing that I enjoy most about my job and role here. I absolutely love working with our students. Think they're just incredible people, and really look forward to watching them progress to their profession.
I agree. I mean, that's why I teach. I absolutely love it. I love teaching, and I learn so much from the students. They give me so much more than I think I give them. So I absolutely love it. I agree with what you're saying. We always finish the podcast with a Keener contest, and the Keener contest I thought this week would be earlier in the podcast. Dr. Chris Carpenter mentioned a report that has just been released for the 21st century on the status of medicine. There was an original report in the 20th century, and I'm not going to give you the name of it, and I want you to be the first person to email me at thesgem@gmail.com with the name of the report, when it was done, and what it was about, and I will send you a cool skeptical gift. So, in closing, be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you learned it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Talk to all the generations next week.